My sister vanished on the last day of school in 2001. They called her a runaway, but I always knew something darker happened. And 20 years later, with nothing but TikTok, trauma, and a mountain of secrets, I cracked the silence wide open. This isn't just a story about a cold case. It's about a father accused of murder, a trial with no body, and a little sister who refused to stop screaming until the world finally listened. My name is Sarah Turney, and this is Alyssa's story, her voice, her legacy, her fight for justice told by me. Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you, TikTok Activism Solves a Cold Case. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. The Last Day I Saw Her. Told from the perspective of Sarah Turney. They say time heals everything. I call bullshit. Time doesn't heal, it buries. It buries pain under fake smiles and small talk, under holidays that come and go without her, under the weight of birthdays we never got to celebrate again. And if you're not careful, it can bury the truth too. That's why I've spent the last 2 decades clawing through dirt and lies, digging with bare hands through silence, trying to bring my sister, Alyssa Turney, back from the dead. But the last day I saw her? It never left me. May 17, 2001. I was 12, barely starting to understand the world, still clinging to the idea that adults were supposed to protect you, that families were sacred, that if someone said they loved you, they meant it. I was wearing my favorite jeans and a pink hoodie that morning, the one Alyssa said made me look like a walking bubblegum ad. She rolled her eyes and laughed at me, like she always did. That was our routine. Our love was tough, sharp-edged, loud. She had this magnetic energy, this way of making you feel like you were part of her private rebellion. She wore thick eyeliner, had a playlist of angry girl bands she blasted before school, and never let anyone tell her who to be. She was wild in a way I didn't fully understand yet. Wild in a way that scared our dad, Michael Turney, our stepdad. But I just called him Dad. I thought he was weird, obsessively neat, paranoid, always tinkering with the security cameras he installed all over the house. He worked for the electrical union and used to be a cop, and he walked around with that same stiff spine and empty stare, like he was waiting for war to break out inside our kitchen. But I never imagined he could hurt us. Not back then. That morning, Alyssa was tense. I remember watching her eat cereal like she was chewing gravel. She was quiet. Too quiet. When I asked if she was okay, she just shrugged and said, "Last day of junior year. Who gives a shit?" She slammed her bowl in the sink and stormed off. She always made exits feel dramatic, like she was part of a movie none of us were cool enough to understand. I didn't know it yet, but that would be the last time I saw her alive. I went to school, played Foursquare at lunch, came home expecting to hear her music blasting through the walls, or her bitching about something stupid like parking spots or boys. Instead, the house was silent. Dad was sitting at the kitchen table, drinking his usual can of Diet Dr. Pepper. The look on his face wasn't worried. It wasn't sad. It was calculated. "She's gone," he said. "What do you mean she's gone?" I asked, my 12-year-old voice cracking in confusion. "She ran away," he said. "Left this." He handed me a piece of paper, a short note written in rushed handwriting on a torn notebook page. It said, "Dad and Sarah, I'm sorry. I can't take it anymore. I'm leaving and I won't be back. Don't try to find me. I'm going to California. I need to be free." My stomach dropped. The handwriting looked like hers, but it felt off. Forced. Like someone trying to copy what a teenage runaway might say if they were writing a bad soap opera script. "She really just left," I whispered. "She's always been dramatic," he muttered, shaking his head. "She'll be back. Or not. That's her choice." That was it. No phone calls to her friends. No missing person report. No driving around to look for her. Just silence. Days passed. Then weeks. Then months. And Alyssa never came back. But Michael? He didn't seem worried. He didn't shed a tear. Instead, he started locking her door, keeping it like a museum. When I snuck in once, I found her clothes still folded, her backpack still on the floor, her toothbrush still damp. She hadn't packed. She hadn't planned. She hadn't run away. But no one listened. Cops took the note at face value. "She's 17, they said. "She's allowed to leave." They brushed it off like she was just another rebellious teen, another statistic. Another runaway who didn't want to be found. But I knew, deep down I knew, something was wrong. Years went by, and I kept trying to forget. I tried to be a normal kid. I joined clubs. I got good grades. I tried to laugh when the other girls talked about their sisters, as if I didn't have a hole in my chest where Alyssa's voice used to live. But that ache never left. It followed me into adulthood, like a ghost riding shotgun. And Michael? He got weirder. Paranoid. Controlling. I wasn't allowed to date. He tracked my phone before it was normal to do that. He kept a file cabinet filled with evidence of things I never did, who I talked to, what I wore, notes from teachers' school schedules. He installed more cameras. Audio recorders. Once I found one hidden in my vent. I confronted him. He said it was for protection. I began to realize he was preparing for something, or covering something up. It wasn't until I was in my 20s that I started digging. I pulled out Alyssa's journals from the attic. I found letters where she described Dad as creepy. She said he was too close, that he watched her sleep, that he would flip out if she talked to boys. One entry just read, "If anything ever happens to me, it's him." My blood turned to ice. That's when the rage set in. I started talking, asking questions, posting online, first on Reddit, then on Instagram. But nothing made a dent, until 2019, when I downloaded TikTok. At first, it felt ridiculous. Posting about a decades-old cold case on a platform filled with dance trends and makeup tutorials? But something told me to try. I filmed a 15-second clip about Alyssa, showed her photo, the note, my suspicions. It went viral. Then I posted again, and again, and again. Each time, I shared more of the story, the audio tapes, the files, the surveillance obsession, the things I had kept bottled up for years. Millions started watching, commenting, sharing, demanding answers. Suddenly, the silence was broken. Police reopened the case. The media called. Podcasts asked for interviews. I went from being the forgotten little sister to the voice of a movement. But the deeper I went, the more dangerous it felt. I was accusing my own father of murder. And he knew it. He started threatening lawsuits. Showed up to interviews. Called me mentally unstable. But I didn't stop. I couldn't. Because that house I grew up in was filled with secrets. And I knew, I fucking knew, that behind the cameras, behind the lies, behind the runaway narrative was the truth. Alyssa didn't leave us. She was taken. And I was going to make sure the world finally saw it. Chapter 2, Viral Justice. They say going viral feels like lightning. Fast. Bright. Powerful. But what they don't tell you is that it also burns. It was late one night in 2019, and I was lying on the living room floor, scrolling through TikTok like I always did when the grief got too heavy. I had just passed another one of those stupid filters that turned your face into a dog when something in my gut said, "Try it again. Tell them. Just tell them." I sat up, pulled out Alyssa's photo, and recorded a 15-second video. No music. No effects. Just my trembling voice, and a picture of the sister I hadn't seen in nearly two decades. I said, "My sister went missing in 2001. The cops called it a runaway. But I think our dad killed her." I stared at the screen for a long time after I posted it. My hand was shaking. My heart was hammering against my ribs so hard it felt like it was trying to escape my chest. I thought I'd wake up the next morning to maybe 10 views, a couple of trolls calling me a liar. But by the time I opened the app the next morning, the video had exploded. Hundreds of thousands of views. Tens of thousands of likes. Comments flooding in like a tsunami. "Wait, what? You can't just say that and leave. Girl, make this a series. Tag the FBI. Right now. We believe you." I wasn't ready for it. I don't think anyone ever is. It felt like a tidal wave of validation crashing into the years of silence I'd been drowning in. Suddenly, I wasn't just the girl with the missing sister. I was the girl with the story. And people were listening. So I kept posting. I dug through the files I'd hidden in the back of my closet. Old police reports, grainy VHS tapes, audio recordings my dad made obsessively. See, Michael recorded everything. Phone calls. Conversations. Hell, even random background noise in the house. But the one thing missing from his massive archive? Any footage from the day Alyssa disappeared. How convenient. I posted a new video. My dad recorded everything. But not the day my sister went missing. Ask yourself why. Boom. Another million views. And the comments got louder. More aggressive. More supportive. Strangers started joining in, making their own videos, tagging Arizona police, demanding justice. I wasn't alone anymore. But going viral is a double-edged sword. With the attention came trolls. Some called me a clout chaser. Others said I was lying for likes. And worse, Dad found out. He emailed me. Called me. Left voicemails filled with threats dressed in polite language. Sarah, please refrain from spreading misinformation. I could take legal action. You're unstable. I posted the voicemails too. Let the world hear his voice, cold and rehearsed, the same voice that once tucked me into bed and told me monsters weren't real. Only they were. And one had been sitting at our dinner table the whole time. I remember the exact moment everything shifted. It was when I released the clip where I read from Alyssa's journal. Her own handwriting, raw and unfiltered. If anything ever happens to me, it's Michael. The video went nuclear. People lost their minds. News stations started calling. Podcasts wanted interviews. The words "true crime TikTok" became part of headlines. I was terrified, but also relieved. Because for the first time in 19 years, someone gave a damn. And then something unbelievable happened. The Phoenix Police Department reopened the case. It was surreal. I was sitting in my apartment, eating leftover pad thai, when I got the call. "We'd like to ask you a few more questions, Sarah. We're reopening your sister's file." I dropped the fork. I sobbed so hard I couldn't speak. But the high didn't last. Behind the scenes, it became clear they weren't thrilled about being pressured into action by a social media campaign. I could hear it in their voices. The annoyance, the condescension, the passive-aggressive, "we're doing our best" lines. Still, I kept pushing. In early 2020, I sat down for a podcast interview. A big one. Tens of thousands of listeners. I laid it all out. How Dad had tried to control Alyssa. How she planned to tell a teacher about the abuse. How she had never been seen again after that day. I said what I had never said out loud before. "I believe my father murdered my sister." It felt like jumping off a cliff. But instead of falling, I flew. After the episode aired, more evidence came in. People who had been silent for years came forward. An old friend of Alyssa's, a former co-worker of Michael's. They told stories that matched mine. That confirmed the darkness I'd always known was there. And finally, in August 2020, after almost 2 decades of nothing, Michael Turney was arrested for the second-degree murder of Alyssa Turney. I stared at my phone in disbelief as I read the headlines. "My dad. In handcuffs. Mugshot. Charges." I laughed and cried at the same time. The world spun around me. But even in that moment, I couldn't celebrate. Because her body still hadn't been found. There was no smoking gun. No confession. Just circumstantial evidence. I'd pulled the monster into the light. But the question remained, would justice actually stick? Chapter 3. The trial of the century that never was. There's this lie people like to believe, that when you finally get justice, it brings peace. Like once the handcuffs click shut and the judge bangs the gavel, all the years of pain suddenly melt away and you can breathe again. But that's not how it works. Not when the man who ripped your family apart is sitting in a courtroom, smirking. Not when justice is a game of evidence and yours is a story told in fragments, journals, and trauma-shaped memories. Michael Turney was arrested in 2020. The headlines made it sound like a victory. Stepfather charged in 2001 cold case. My inbox flooded. Reporters wanted quotes. Strangers sent messages of celebration. People posted memes of Alyssa's photo next to prison bars with captions like, "We got him, sis." But I wasn't celebrating. Not really. Because I knew what was coming. See, the thing about a cold case is, it doesn't just get warm because of feelings. Feelings don't count in court. Social media attention? TikTok virality? Podcast listeners? None of that matters when you're standing in front of a judge. What matters is evidence. Direct. Tangible. Bulletproof. And we didn't have it. We had Alyssa's journals. Her cries for help. We had Michael's obsession with surveillance. Except for that one day where, conveniently, there were no tapes. We had witnesses saying he was controlling, abusive, paranoid. But we didn't have a body. We didn't have DNA. We didn't have video proof, or a weapon, or a clear timeline. And that's where the cracks began to show. I remember the first time I saw him again, in person. It was in the courtroom. August 2021. I walked in with my hands clenched so hard the nails dug crescent moons into my palms. I felt like I was walking into a lion's den wearing a target on my back. And there he was. Michael Turney. The man who used to make me pancakes on Sundays. The man who gave me my first cell phone. The man who, when I was 9, sat next to me in the hospital after I broke my arm and told me everything would be okay. The man who, I now believed, had murdered my sister. He looked older. Gray around the edges. Slower. But the look in his eyes hadn't changed. Cold. Flat. Like a doll's. He turned to me. He smiled. As if this was all just a joke to him. As if the 20 years of silence, the shattered pieces of my life, the screaming in my chest that never stopped, none of it mattered. He whispered something to his lawyer, then turned back to face the judge like this was traffic court. My stomach twisted. I sat in the front row, gripping my phone with one hand and a folded copy of Alyssa's journal in the other. The page she wrote when she was 15, the one where she said, "He watches me too much. It's not normal. If I disappear, don't believe him." The courtroom felt too quiet, too neat, like it didn't deserve to be the setting for something so ugly. And then it began. The prosecution laid it all out. They presented the controlling behavior, his obsession with watching her, the threats Alyssa made to report him, the fact that she told friends and teachers she didn't feel safe. They played clips of Michael rambling about the government, about unions, about conspiracies. They revealed the fact that he took a trip to California right after she disappeared, conveniently where her note claimed she was going. But then came the defense, and they ripped everything apart. They called the case emotionally charged and publicly influenced. They called me an internet celebrity, trying to rewrite history. They said Alyssa did run away, that she was angry, that she was manipulative, that she was a wild teenager who got in over her head and left of her own free will. They said there was no body, no DNA, no confession. They said the note was real. And they said that the real tragedy here was mine, that I was a grieving sister looking for someone to blame, that my TikToks were just dramatized speculation. And the worst part, they made it stick. Day after day, I sat there as my sister's life was reduced to sound bites, as strangers picked apart her character, as her pain became evidence and her absence became doubt. I went home every night and screamed into my pillow. I started second-guessing myself. What if I was wrong? What if Alyssa had run away? What if I had spent the last 5 years destroying the life of a man who, somehow, despite everything, wasn't guilty? That doubt, it eats at you. And then came the day I had to testify. I walked up to the stand with shaking knees and a heart pounding so loudly, I thought it would burst. They asked me to state my name, my relation to Alyssa, and I said, "My name is Sarah Turney. I'm her little sister. And I'm here because I believe with every ounce of my being that my father murdered her." I told them about the journals, the things Alyssa said, the way Dad erased her from our lives, the evidence he didn't have, the way he controlled us. I told them about the threats, about finding audio recorders hidden in vents, about the night Alyssa whispered to me, "Don't trust him." I told the truth, the ugly, unfiltered, agonizing truth. And I cried, not tears of performance, not for pity, tears from the place where grief lives, where trauma hardens into armor, where your soul knows it's breaking but you do it anyway, because someone has to tell the fucking truth. But in the end, it wasn't enough. In July 2023, Michael Turney was found not guilty of second-degree murder. I sat in that courtroom as the verdict was read and the breath was sucked from my body. It felt like dying a second time, like losing Alyssa all over again. Reporters flooded the hallway. Microphones shoved in my face. "How do you feel? What's next? Do you think justice was served?" I wanted to scream, to tear the walls down brick by brick, to yell that justice had nothing to do with it. But instead, I said, "Alyssa deserved better, and I won't stop until she gets it, because here's the truth they won't put in the newspapers. The justice system failed us, not because we were wrong, but because we couldn't prove it in the way they needed. Because the monster wore a mask made of law degrees and clean shirts and decades of lies. Because in the end, truth isn't always enough. Not in court, but it's enough for me. And it's enough for Alyssa. And it's enough for the millions who now know her name." Chapter 4. Echoes after the verdict. I thought the verdict would be the end of something. Instead, it was the beginning of everything I didn't know how to feel. The moment the words "not guilty" left the judge's mouth, it felt like the floor dropped out from beneath me. Not just metaphorically, my knees buckled. My lungs forgot how to breathe. My fingers went numb as I gripped the wooden edge of the courtroom bench, like it could anchor me to reality. But there was no anchor. No closure. No cinematic swell of justice. Just silence. Michael stood, calm as ever, like he'd just won a fucking poker game. His lawyer patted his back like this was a win they'd strategized for. A handshake. A nod. A smile in my direction. A fucking smile. I didn't even cry, not at first. I just stared, frozen, as if my body refused to acknowledge that I had failed her, that I had dragged my sister's story into the spotlight, begged the world to listen, walked through hellfire, and still ended up right back where I started. No answers. No accountability. No Alyssa. The days that followed blurred into one long nightmare of bright lights and empty words. Media vans camped outside my apartment. I'd open my phone to find my face plastered across news apps and YouTube thumbnails. TikTok activist reacts to stepdad's acquittal. True crime sensation or social media overreach? Did the internet fail Alyssa Turney? One outlet even called the verdict the collapse of a viral justice fantasy. That one broke me. Because this wasn't a fantasy. It was my life. My trauma. My sister's life. Her death. I stopped checking my phone. Stopped responding to messages. My voicemail filled up with supporters, reporters, hate mail. I didn't care. None of it could undo the damage. I stopped eating. Stopped sleeping. I'd sit on the edge of my bed for hours, staring at nothing, replaying every decision I'd made like some cruel mental edit reel. Maybe I should have waited before going public. Maybe I shouldn't have pushed the TikTok campaign so hard. Maybe I made too many enemies. Maybe I made it worse. I don't remember the first day I broke down, but I remember how it felt. It came like a slow wave, building just under the skin, until one morning I opened the cabinet and saw her old hairbrush, Alyssa's, still tucked in the back behind bottles of sunscreen and expired cold medicine. And I collapsed, right there on the bathroom floor, screaming, shaking, screaming so loud my throat burned. Because in that moment, it hit me like a fucking freight train. He's free, and she's still gone, and I might never find her. I stayed in that darkness longer than I care to admit. People assume advocacy is this noble thing, that when you fight for someone you love, it empowers you. But they don't see the rot underneath. The toll it takes on your body, your mind, your relationships, your soul. I lost friends. I lost trust. I lost the last shred of belief that the system would catch up to evil in time. But Alyssa didn't get to take a break. She didn't get to disappear into depression or hide from the headlines. She was silenced forever. And I had promised her, sworn to her memory, that I'd never stop until the truth came out. So one night I got up. I poured a glass of water, sat down, and opened TikTok. The camera stared back at me like an old friend I hadn't called in a while. I hit record, and I spoke. I know a lot of you watched the trial. I know you saw the verdict. And I know a lot of you are hurting with me right now. But let me say this loud and clear. This isn't over. Not for me. Not for Alyssa. I paused. The silence held. I don't need a courtroom to validate what I know in my gut. I don't need a verdict to believe my sister deserved better. And I sure as hell don't need permission to keep fighting. The video hit over 2 million views in 48 hours. Comments poured in. Thousands of people, survivors, siblings, cold case advocates, rallying behind Alyssa all over again, sharing her name, sharing her face, posting their own stories of injustice, their own silences. I realized something then, something huge. This was never just about Alyssa. Yes, she was the catalyst, the heartbreak that sparked the fire. But she had become a symbol for every girl who was erased, every case left cold, every victim dismissed because their trauma didn't come with a GPS coordinate or a confession on tape. The system had failed her. But the people, they hadn't. That's when I made the decision to take it further. I started organizing. Not just TikToks or Instagram posts. I built a website. I launched a nonprofit. I called it Voices for the Missing. Its mission was simple. Help families with cold cases use the same tools I had, social media, digital activism, community pressure, to break the silence around their own stories. I partnered with legal advisors, podcast hosts, former detectives. I did interviews, not just about Alyssa anymore, but about what the system does to families like ours. How it breaks you down, gaslights you, forces you to accept a story that never sat right in your bones. And I started traveling, college campuses, crime conferences, virtual panels. I told anyone who'd listen about the power of a girl with a camera and a broken heart. And slowly, I watched the movement grow. I watched other sisters rise up, other families go viral. I watched as our story became a blueprint. And through all of that, I kept talking about her. I kept saying her name, Alyssa Turney, over and over, because silence is how killers win. And I wasn't going to let that happen. Not again. One night, around 2 a.m., I was sitting in my living room surrounded by files, letters, and Alyssa's old t-shirts when a message came in. A girl, 19, her sister went missing when she was 11. She wrote, "Your videos gave me the courage to talk to the police again. I always thought no one would believe me. But they're reopening her case. Because of you." I stared at the screen for a long time. and for the first time in weeks, I smiled. Not because everything was okay, not because justice had been served, but because change had started, and maybe, just maybe, that meant something. Chapter 5, Legacy isn't just a word. People talk about closure like it's a door you get to slam shut once the pain's had its turn. Like one day you wake up, make peace with it all, and walk away clean. That's a lie. Closure isn't a door. It's a wound that stops bleeding, but never quite scars. It's the story you keep telling because the person who lived it can't. And for me, closure never came in a courtroom. It didn't come in a press release. It didn't even come when Michael Turney walked free. It came slowly, in pieces, in the quiet, in the decision to keep living, even if justice had failed. It's strange, isn't it? The way the world moves on. After the verdict, the news cycle shifted. Another story. Another scandal. Another disappearance. Alyssa's face stopped showing up in my feed. The podcasts moved on. The hashtags slowed. But I couldn't move on. Because my life, the one before Alyssa vanished, ended in 2001. Everything since then has been a war. And every war needs a reason to keep going. I found mine in the smallest places. A letter from a girl who said my TikTok saved her from staying silent about her abuse. A mother who emailed me after a panel to say she found strength in my voice. A retired detective who said, "Your case changed how we treat runaways now." Tiny echoes, ripples in the water. Each one reminded me. This fight was bigger than a verdict. It was bigger than Michael Turney. It was even bigger than Alyssa. Because when you turn pain into purpose, when you refuse to let grief bury truth, you become more than a victim. You become a weapon, and weapons change the world. There's this box I keep in the corner of my closet. I've had it since I moved out. It's taped shut with old stickers on the sides. Inside are pieces of Alyssa, her green hoodie, her journal with the frayed edges, a cassette tape labeled Summer 2000, a folded note she once passed me in math class that just says, "Don't tell Dad. He'd freak. But I love you. Forever." Sometimes I open it, just to remind myself she was real. That she wasn't just a story, or a cause, or a trend. She was my big sister. She taught me how to do eyeliner. She once faked a fever with me so we could skip school together and go to the mall. She could quote every line from Clueless. And when I had my first panic attack at 13, she was the one who sat with me on the bathroom floor and whispered, "You're okay. You're not crazy. Just breathe." She was real. And I will spend the rest of my life making sure the world remembers that. A few months after the trial, I went to the desert. Not for symbolism or some poetic reason. I just needed air. I drove until I was surrounded by nothing but sky and heat, and the kind of silence that doesn't ask anything of you. I parked, got out, and screamed. Like really screamed. The kind that starts in your stomach and rips through your lungs like it's trying to drag the grief out by force. I screamed for Alyssa. I screamed for the years we lost. I screamed for the version of me that thought the justice system would work. And when I was done, I stood there, alone, quiet, breathing. I realized something in that moment. Alyssa didn't need me to carry her pain anymore. She needed me to carry her story, not as a tragedy, but as a revolution. So that's what I do now. I speak in rooms where no one wants to talk about abuse, or missing girls, or the failures of the system. I go to high schools, law schools. I sit across from people in power and say, "You didn't just fail her. You failed thousands." I help families start their own campaigns. I give them blueprints, tools, hope. We've had 6 cold cases reopened in the last year alone. And I keep using my voice, not because it's easy, but because silence is how we lost her in the first place. There's a mural now, in Phoenix, a painting of Alyssa smiling, wearing that faded blue tank top she loved. Next to her face it says, "Speak even when your voice shakes." Sometimes I sit across the street from it, watch strangers walk past. Some stop and take photos. Some don't know who she is. Some will Google her later. But for a moment she's seen. She's remembered. That's all I ever wanted. People still ask me what I'd say to Michael if I saw him again. I don't know. Maybe nothing. Maybe I'd just look at him and think, "You tried to erase her. You tried to bury the truth. But you couldn't. Because the internet remembered. Because I remembered. Because Alyssa didn't vanish. She multiplied. Her voice became mine. And mine became millions. I know now that justice isn't a destination. It's a fucking battlefield. It's losing and showing up anyway. It's failing and fighting harder. Alyssa taught me that. Even in her absence, she became my compass. I don't have all the answers. I may never know where her body is. I may never get a confession. But I have her story. And that story is louder than ever. So if you're listening to this, if you made it to the end of this audiobook, I want you to remember something. Don't wait for justice to come knocking. Sometimes, you have to bang the damn door down yourself.